Okay, I think we're back. Yes, we're recording again. So I'd like to begin reading the book. Now, the first thing I'd like you to do is, I hope you all have a copy. If you don't have a copy in front of you, there are copies here. Please read them. Please have it in front of you. It's really well worth it. Don't even buy it if you can't. I mean, it's about as cheap a lifesaver as you'll ever buy. How much is the soft cover? It's $10 or something like that, and the hardcover is $12. We have a hardcover. We have lots of copies of the big book, so please, please borrow it. I think we need one there. And what I'd like you to do is turn to the title page of the big book, and that's before, way before page one, the title page.
So if you don't buy them, just drop them off.
Just drop them back. If you don't have the money on you now, bring it tomorrow. Take the book home with you and read it and bring the money tomorrow. If you don't pay, it's your problem, no one else's. So you turn to the title page and you see it says, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. You'll note that they say recovered. They don't say are recovering, but they say recovered. And the big book uses the word recovered all the time. It uses the word recovering only once in the entire first 164 pages of the big book. And the word recovering at that time is used simply to describe someone who is in the process of beginning to work the steps. But once we finish step 9, the big book guarantees us recovery. And they say we've recovered. And what is recovery? It's to gain that which was lost. We recover something. What do we recover? Our sanity. What is our sanity? The ability to look at the foods that we know are our problems and say, why would I eat this? This is poison to me. Other people can eat it, I can't. That's the sanity that we have recovered from. We've recovered from insanity. Now, most of you will have, it will say fourth edition, is that right? Does anyone have a third edition? Okay, some page numbers are different right at the beginning, so I'll give you the different page numbers for those of you with the third edition. Okay, next I'd like you to turn to the preface, which is found on XI, Roman numerals XI 11. It's right after the table of contents. And just look at the second paragraph of that preface. And just really the first sentence there. It says, because this book has become the basic text for our society. This book calls itself a textbook. And actually, the AA 12 and 12, the book called The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, also calls the big book a textbook. Now, Joe and Charlie say, what is a textbook? A textbook is a book that imparts information from people who have it to those who don't. I mean, that is what a textbook is. That's why you study a textbook. It gives you information which you didn't have, and you get it from people who have that information. And how do you read a textbook? You study it from page one on. You start from the beginning and you go to the end. It's written in such a way as to give you that information in a way that you can understand it and accept it and it makes sense for the study of it. If you're going to study algebra and you'd never studied arithmetic, you would start with arithmetic and go all the way up to algebra. So this is a textbook. There is no other book in Alcoholics, in AA or in OA that calls itself a textbook. We have no other textbook in AA or OA. OA has a number of books. The OA book called The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions of Overeaters Anonymous is a series of essays on the steps. It is not a textbook, and it doesn't pretend to be. It talks about all kinds of different ways of doing the steps. It is not the way of doing the steps. We have book called The Workbook, The 12-Step Workbook of Overeaters Anonymous. It is not approved by the World Service Business Conference of Overeaters Anonymous. It was put together by the Board of Trustees of OA, and it does not represent the group conscience of OA as to how to do the steps. It just consists of a bunch of questions taken from the OA 12 and 12, the 12 steps and 12 traditions. But it is not the OA recommended way of doing the steps because it was not passed by the World Service Business Conference, and it doesn't represent the group conscience of OA. The same with, there's a pamphlet, it's hardly found in Winnipeg, but it's a pamphlet called the Fourth Step Inventory Guide, or the Guide to the Fourth Step Inventory. That is also not approved by the World Service Business Conference, the group conscience of OA. It was put together by the Board of Trustees of OA and consists of questions taken from the OA 12 and 12. But it is not the OA way of doing the steps. The only book that calls itself a textbook in OA or AA is the Big Book. Okay. Yes? The AA 12 and 12 talks about the Big Book as being a textbook. Not a, it's a series of essays. That's all it is. Okay? I'm going to ask you to go now to the forward to the first edition, XIII 13 in Roman numerals. It's the same for all editions. Forward to the first edition. This is the forward as it appeared in the first printing of the first edition in 1939. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered, again, not are recovering, but have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And this theme that there's both the mind and the body is essential to our understanding of our problem. And if we don't understand it, and I rejected an understanding of it for 7 years, 6 or 7 years, which is one of the reasons I relapsed, if we don't understand it, we will not be able to recover to the 12 steps. And the Big Book says this very clearly, and I'll point this out today. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So the main purpose of the book is to show people what we did. And the promise of this book is you do what we did and you'll have the recovery that we have. That's why it's a textbook. It tells you exactly what we did. Okay, I'm going to skip the forward to the second edition. I'm going to go to the forward to the third edition, which is found on XXII 22 in Roman numerals. And if you look at the third paragraph on that page, right in the middle of that paragraph, you'll see a sentence that begins, "The 12 steps that summarize the program." And what is important for that is to realize that from the Big Book perspective, the 12 steps that we read on the wall, that we read at every meeting, is not the 12 steps. They are a summary of the program. And from the Big Book perspective, they are, in effect, the ingredients, and the Big Book is the recipe. The Big Book, as we'll see, actually describes the steps differently from the way they're written on the wall. And we'll see that very, very specifically when we look at step 10, but we'll also see that when we look at step 4. And in understanding the Big Book's directions, we'll show you that one of the problems I had in this program, and maybe some of us have in other respects, is that when we look at the 12 steps, each of the 12 steps that we read at every meeting, and consider those to be the steps, we often treat every one of those steps as being exactly the same importance. And that means that we treat step 6 and step 7 with the same degree of importance and time as we might treat step 4 or step 1 or step 9. The big and hey, if it works, it works. That's I'm happy if it works for you. But from the Big Book perspective, that's not the case. We will find, I'll discuss this tomorrow, that there were only 6 steps to begin with, and that they did not include steps 3, step 6, step 7, even step 8, step 10. And you'll see why as we go through the steps. You'll see why the different steps have different reasons for being there, and I'll go into the history of that. I would ask you then to turn to page. Now the numbers become slightly different. In the fourth edition is XXV, in the third edition is XXIII. It's 23 in the third edition and 25 in the fourth edition, because the third edition does not have 2 pages of the forward to the fourth edition. The third edition doesn't have the forward to the fourth edition, because of course there was no fourth edition when the third edition was printed. If I give you the fourth edition, subtract 2 and you'll get the third edition. You've got the doctor's opinion. Now, the doctor was a man we will not meet much in the Big Book, because I'm not going to go through Bill's story which is the first chapter of the big book, where he talks, I will tell you about it though. His name was Dr. William Silkworth, and he was a doctor who worked at a hospital called the Towns Hospital in New York. If you have this book that I wrote, I was able to find pictures of the Towns Hospital, and there's an ad for the Towns Hospital rehabilitation program in it, somewhere in here. I don't know which page it is. And you can see that. It's kind of neat to look at. And there's a picture of Dr. Silkworth in the book I've written as well. Dr. Silkworth he was called a saint. He was loved by a bunch of AAers, loved by a lot of alcoholics, because he cared deeply about alcoholics, and he treated thousands and thousands of alcoholics in his life, and considered them, until AA came around, to be pretty hopeless. He had a drying out facility. He administered all the treatments that you were supposed to administer to have people, you know, dry out and get over the heebie-jeebies and the, you know, the DTs, delirium tremens, that you can get if you've been terribly addicted to alcohol. He'd dry them out in all kinds of different ways, and they'd go out and they'd drink again. And then he'd dry them out again. They'd drink again. It was a good business. Like every diet program is a really great business. If you keep going back to it, you know, it's great. But he despaired. And in 1933, it might have been 1930, I think it was 33, he published a series of papers in which he set out a new theory of alcoholism. Up to that time, alcoholism was considered to be kind of like a moral problem, a disease of the mind, a problem of people, you know, that we hear people say, it's not willpower, it's won't power, you know, why don't you just exercise your won't power? And it was just sort of trying to persuade people to become more resolute in just not drinking, just don't drink. And he published a theory that was pretty radical for his time. And it was so radical, by the way, that when he wrote these letters that were published in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the first edition of the book, which was printed in 1939, his name wasn't put in. It was Dr. Blank, you know, Dr. Line. There was never his name wasn't in there, because it was considered so radical that he was afraid to put, I don't know, afraid, but he didn't put his name down. And his theory was very simple, and it's contained in this chapter. And his theory was that there's something wrong with the body of the alcoholic as much as with the mind. And it was his attempt to explain what went on with the body that really was quite radical. Everyone knew there was something wrong with the mind. It wasn't well expressed, but the body was really important. And he developed this theory that we'll discuss as we read this chapter. He writes two letters in this doctor's opinion. The first letter is a short one. It's on the first page of the doctor's opinion. It's basically a letter of recommendation. It basically says what's in this book is great. And if you just turn the page, just the next page to that chapter, you'll see he ends his letter of reference but says, you may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves, which is a pretty good letter of recommendation. And then the authors of the big book in the larger typeface begin, they make a comment. They say, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. I rejected this statement for 6 or 7 years. I rejected it consciously. I would read this and I say, that's not true. Doctors tell me that's not a problem with my mind, with my body, it's only with my mind. I can eat everything in moderation. I believed what I was told by doctors, by nutritionists, by all the diet books I read, by all the diets and magazines, and by the weight loss programs that I investigated and joined. You can eat anything once you lose your weight. And I believe there's nothing wrong with my body. It was just a matter of moderation. But the big book says you must believe it. You must believe that there's something wrong with your body. And what is it that's wrong with your body? First of all, why? They say it didn't satisfy us to be told we couldn't control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure, we're certain, that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. Now that's a really powerful and important statement. And it's the purpose of this chapter, the doctor's opinion, to explain why that's the case. They go on and they say the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. And I read that and I said, I don't have an allergy to food. I love food. I don't break out in rashes. I don't get anaphylactic shock when I eat food. I go into ecstasy when I eat food. I love food. How can you say I'm allergic to food? And my friend, this friend who really, really, really read the big book, said, that's not what allergy means. I said, that's exactly what allergy means. Allergy means that. You take pills for allergies. The allergies give you hives. They give you rashes. They do things to your body that are horrible. Nothing horrible happens to me when I eat. And he said, look it up. Well, I looked up the word allergy, and it was fascinating because I couldn't find it in my old dictionaries. It didn't exist in the English language until the early 1900s. And it comes from the Greek, and it means simply, originally, this is what it meant, an abnormal physical reaction to a physical substance. Any abnormal physical reaction. Now, we've come to understand it as meaning an abnormal reaction that somehow makes our bodies worse, in bad shape. What we'll find out is that the allergy, the abnormal physical reaction that the doctor talks about, is cravings, uncontrollable cravings. And that's the allergic reaction that the doctor was talking about. So the big book says the theory that we have an allergy interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may of course mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So this whole concept of the allergy is something I rejected for years because I didn't understand what it meant. If I had known that an allergy means an abnormal reaction, that abnormal reaction in the case of an addict is cravings, that would have made some sense to me. But I thought it meant something else, and I rejected the concept. Why should we believe that we have an allergy? There are four reasons that make sense to me. The first is that we should no longer feel guilt about overeating, because there's something wrong with our bodies. And we should not feel guilt when we find we can't stop once we start. That image of me eating the food and having the hand come to the mouth and saying to myself, I gotta stop, why can't I stop? I'm gaining weight, why can't I stop? And the food is still going. I no longer feel guilty about that because I know it's not my mind, it's my body. And my body is overpowering my mind. It's uncontrollable. My body, can I stop blinking? Well, for 5 minutes, maybe. Actually, no, I can't stop blinking for 5 minutes. I can stop blinking for 1 minute. Can I stop breathing? 2 or 3 minutes. Can I stop my heart from beating? No. There are parts of my body I cannot control. And what I have to understand is I can't control these cravings. It's like Audrey the flower in Little Shop of Horrors, you know, more. More. And my body's more blood or whatever she said. I want more. Give me more. And I cannot stop. That's the first reason. The second reason is that clearly the answer to the allergy is the answer to any allergy. Don't go near the stuff that causes the allergy. You abstain. You have to abstain from the things that cause the allergy. Now, that's enough for any alcoholic to know, because alcoholics join Alcoholics Anonymous, drug addicts join Narcotics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous, gamblers join Gamblers Anonymous. They know. You abstain. You stop from your addictive substance or behavior. You just don't take it. You don't go to Alcoholics Anonymous and say, I'm going to continue to drink and work the program. And you know that. But for us in OA, we have another problem. Because we are not Chocoholics Anonymous, we're not Fataholics Anonymous, we're not Sugaraholics Anonymous, we're not Floweraholics Anonymous. We are a group of people who all agree we have a compulsive problem and that we are addicted, but as it turns out, each one of us has his or her own particular allergy. And there are people in this room, and I certainly know people in OA, probably people in this room, and I know for certain in OA, who can eat everything I cannot eat, and I can eat everything that they can't eat. So that from an extreme point of view, there are people in OA who have absolutely different allergies, or allergies to different things. Many of us overlap. Most of us have a lot of similarities. But one of the most important things, and the third reason why this is important from OA to understand the allergy, is that understanding the symptom of the allergy allows us to figure out what we as individuals have to abstain from. And what I have to abstain from may be very different from what you have to abstain from, and vice versa. And the one thing that OA stands for, because we have a pamphlet called The Dignity of Choice, which represents the group conscience of OA, it was passed by the World Service Business Conference. It says, don't accept another person's plan of eating, because that person's plan of eating may not be your plan of eating. Don't just accept it holus bolus. You may have different problems, and you may have to abstain from different things. The fourth reason that it's good to know that we have an allergy is that it provides us with a wonderful excuse for those among us who are people pleasers. And I venture to think that there may be some people pleasers in this audience. I know that I have been a people pleaser, and I know many people who identify with people pleasing in OA. And that is, if someone offers us something that we know we can't have, we can say, no thanks, I just found out I'm allergic to it. Who would give you something you're allergic to? Now, they may go so far as to ask you, what happens when you ingest it? I'll give you three answers that I've heard. My answer is simple. I break out into uncontrollable cravings, so I can't have it. Another person said, I break out in fat. And the third one, I love this one, my bum begins to swell. Which I thought was pretty good. You could say my stomach swells or something like that, but I thought that's pretty good too. But I prefer to say uncontrollable cravings. But whatever it is, who's going to give you something you're allergic to? Who's going to say, oh, you can have a little bit if you're allergic to it, you know? I know there's one person in this room who's allergic to peanuts. And I know that that person has actually taken risks because of the compulsive eating aspect. I'd never take a risk with peanuts. I'd never take a risk with shrimp, I tell you. I don't like peanuts or shrimp that well that I would take that kind of a risk, but I fully understand how someone could. Because I've taken risks with all kinds of things. I watched my mother, who had diabetes and ultimately died of diabetes or diabetes-related illnesses. She had diabetes, she was told you can't have sugar. They've probably changed the diet since then, but this is back in the 60s. And I remember watching her eat things with sugar in it and joke about it and say, a little bit won't hurt me. And it did. And the last 4 years of her life were pretty difficult, miserable years for her. She had a stroke. A woman who talked brilliantly and wonderfully and eloquently was reduced to a couple words at a time. She couldn't talk very well because of the stroke. She was in constant pain. She was a very difficult time. And how did that happen? She didn't abstain from things that she clearly should have abstained from. But I've got to tell you, shrimp, certainly. I mean, I haven't had peanuts for a long time because I stay away from peanuts. They're one of my binge foods. I'll talk about the exceptions to that. But shrimp is something I eat. But I'll tell you very frankly, if I found out I'd get an anaphylactic shock that my neck would, what happens, it swells and I choke, I'd look at shrimp a little differently. I'd say, gee, it was a good ride, but I don't want shrimp anymore, you know? My wife, who's a chocoholic, if she were told you can't eat chocolate anymore, we just discovered that you're allergic to it, I've asked her how she would say. She would say, I would resent it terribly. I would weep about it, but I would never have another piece of chocolate. Sane people don't have things that cause them illness, right? So that's why we do this. Now, let's just go on. What is this allergy? What is the symptom of this allergy? I want to point out, if you look at the bottom of that same page we're looking at, which is 26XXVI in the fourth edition, 24XXIV in the third, it says, more often than not, it is imperative, it's necessary, that a man's brain be cleared before he's approached, right? In other words, that he stop drinking. Now, just go right over to the bottom of the next page, where the doctor, we've now got smaller writing here, this is the doctor writing, says, of course an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor. Do you see that? Those are the only major mentions in the Big Book of Sobriety. The Big Book assumes sobriety, as Alcoholics Anonymous assumes. You just assume, of course you're going to be sober when you work the steps. How can you work the steps and be drunk? I suppose there are alcoholics who think they can do that, but very few of them end up succeeding. And yet in OA, as I've been in it for a long time, and there are people who have been in it for a long time who I'm sure will agree with me, there has been at times when people have said, I can work the steps and still eat, and the steps will give me recovery. I've heard that. As a matter of fact, a good friend of mine in this program, who knew the big book better than I'll ever know it, died in this disease, died by his own hand in this disease, and he thought he could work the steps without getting sober, without abstaining. And I know that personally because I talked to him about it. The big book takes sobriety for granted, and I take abstinence for granted. For me, step one begins with abstinence. One wonderful speaker who's passed on now once said at an OA meeting years at an OA convention years and years ago, step one is all about abstinence. And it is the beginning. We get sober. We stop eating. And then we're in a race. Are we going to work the steps and get to step nine and recover before our mind comes back and gives us permission to eat? That's the race we're in. The faster we can work the steps, the more we'll beat our minds. But if we wait a long time, our minds will come back and say, you can have some. You've been really good for a while. And that's the race that we're in. I'll talk more about that. So if you look at the top of that page that we were just at from the doctor, which is 28 Roman numerals in fourth and 26 Roman numerals in third, the first full paragraph says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. A manifestation is a symptom of an allergy. And what is that manifestation, that symptom? The phenomenon of craving. Now, what's a phenomenon? We're going to meet this word a few times in the big book. A phenomenon is an occurrence for which there's no explanation. It's just something that happens. We don't know why it happens. It just happens. The plural of phenomenon, it's a Greek word, is phenomena. The phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So once you take in alcohol, you get cravings. That's the manifestation of the allergy. So the allergy is not hives, it's not a swelled throat, it's not coughs, it's not wheezes, it is cravings. That's the way the doctor has done it. Okay. He goes on right at the bottom of that page. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive, it just runs away from you. It's so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, while they admit it injures them, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And I'll tell you, you know, when I was going out with my wife, and I would take her to these fancy restaurants, well, not fancy, but these great ethnic restaurants, and she would study the menu and order a toasted chicken salad sandwich. And, or we go to a Chinese restaurant, I'd be ordering these exotic things, and she'd order, you know, sweet and sour chicken balls, you know, which is sort of, I would look at that and say, that's not Chinese food. They may be served in a Chinese restaurant, it's not what the Chinese eat. And then we go to a movie, and she'd have some licorice or something, and I'd have a huge tub of buttered popcorn, and her some of her licorice, and something else. And then we go out to a pizza place for a snack, and I'd have most of the pizza, and she'd sort of move the food around, you know, a bit and pretend that she ate. I began to think, you know, I'm falling in love with her, but she's sick. She's really sick. She doesn't like food. And I worried about our relationship, about whether it could survive the fact that she didn't like food. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And it's true, I grew up in a family of compulsive eaters. I grew up in a family where you had to eat. Eating was love. And that's true for virtually every ethnic group except my wife's ethnic group, which was English. And, you know, judging with all due respect to her mother, whom I adored, and was really a very fine pastry chef, when it came to cooking, baking she was great at, but cooking food, dinners, was pretty boring. And if I were my wife, I guess I'd be bored by food too, if that's what food was. But I began to think that she was sick. And that's a good example. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I mean, I remember after we were married, and I was doing the cooking. She never learned to cook. Now she's a very good cook, but she had never learned to cook when she was young. We went to her parents for supper on a Sunday or something like that, and it was springtime, and her mother was serving, and my wife went bananas. She said, "Oh, Mom's serving spring potatoes, roasted spring potatoes, those little potatoes, you know, those little small potatoes that used to come out only spring. You can buy them all the time now." And she'd put them at the bottom of the roast pan, and they would get a very crispy, you know, they'd be crispy on the outside and soft on the inside. They tasted good. And my wife would take these little potatoes, and I remember one dinner, she got these potatoes, and she'd cut them in half and gobble the half, just gobble, gobble, gobble. I'd never seen her eat this quickly or this with so much zest, you know, so much relish. And she got to half a potato. Her plate was empty except for half a potato. And she cut that half a potato into half. She ate a quarter, and she put her fork down. And I looked at that quarter of a potato. You all know, eh? And I looked at that quarter of a potato, and very nicely and gently, I said, aren't you going to eat that? She said, "Oh, no, I'm full." I said, but you love it. And she said, "Oh, I just loved it. It was so good. I haven't had these potatoes for a year. I love these potatoes." And I yelled at her, "Why aren't you eating them?" And she looked at me. And I remember, I had this, I mean, it's a long time ago. We've been married over 37 years. But so it must be about 37 years ago. She looked at me and she said, "I'm full." And I was angry at her. I could not understand why she couldn't eat that quarter of a potato. She'd already eaten, you know. Okay, anyway, so to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal. Now, here's some important words. They are right at the bottom of that page. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Right at the bottom of page 28, Roman numerals, in the fourth edition, or 26 in the third edition. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. I want to look at that sentence for a while. Not that long, but for a while. I understand that sense of ease and comfort with food. I know that when I was into my illness, when I was into my addictions, only certain things would satisfy me. I would be restless or irritable and discontent. My body would be, you know, it just wouldn't be. And then suddenly I would have an ice cream, or I'd have a cracker or a potato chip, or I'd have, you know, a cheesecake, or I'd have goose skin, I don't know. And suddenly, my body would say, "I'm at home." Just a, ha. Ah. And I know that feeling. I might not say it quite like that, but that same sense of, "I'm at home, I'm here." And then maybe I would switch from ice cream to crackers, or from crackers to ice cream. I might say, "Well, now I need something else to make me feel at home," because as the big book says, it's elusive, it runs away from you. So you might feel at home, and then suddenly you need something else to give it to you. Just as in a more dramatic situation, the alcoholic might switch from rum to vodka or something like that, or the drug addict might search for a harder drug or a bigger dose or something like that. But whatever it is, that sense of ease and comfort. Now, when I drink, I get a sense of unease and discomfort when I have too much, just as my wife gets a sense of unease and discomfort when she eats too much of something she even loves, like the chocolate the chocolate dessert that she had, that she got too full at. She would bite into it and say, "This is the greatest dessert I've ever had in my life," and eat only half of it, because at a certain point, her body said, "I don't want any more." I think I told you, I did tell you, I had a $90 bottle of wine. I was given a big glass of it. I drank it, and believe me, there is a difference. I'd never had in my mouth any taste of wine ever like that. It was the greatest wine I'd ever had in my life. And I couldn't finish this very full glass, because at a certain point, My body felt unease and discomfort, even though the taste was great. Now, that's me with wine. That's my wife with food. That's never me with food. That's never the alcoholic with alcohol. We have a different body. There is something different about us. Or if you're like me, there's something different about you. There's certainly something different about me. For me, certain things give me the sense of ease and comfort that makes me want more, that gives me these cravings. And Dr. Silkworth goes on, at the bottom of that same page, he talks about, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. He gives that simple example, the one that I joked about with my friend about the person who has the appointment on a Thursday and he has a drink on the Wednesday and then wakes up in a hotel room on the Friday. And, you know, I've never had that experience, but I've certainly had the experience that when I eat, my mind goes completely into the food and doesn't and isn't on anyone else. And I'm eating relentlessly while all around me people are saying, well, let's do something else, or let's go off. And I'm just eating and eating, and my mind just is on it, on the eating. And he goes, if you turn the page to page XXX 30 of the fourth edition, or 28 XXVII of the third, these men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. This is the key. It's a craving that overpowers their mind. And he then goes into a whole bunch of different kinds of alcoholics. He talks about the manic depressive one. He talks about the psychotic ones. He talks about the sane ones. He says, there's nothing they have in common except one thing. And that's found in the second last paragraph on that page. All these and many others, all these different types, have one, only one symptom in common. And what is that symptom? They can't start drinking without developing the phenomenon, the occurrence of craving. It's the only thing they've got in common. The psychotic person, the manic depressive person, and the sane person may have nothing else in common other than, if they are alcoholics, once they start to drink, they get cravings that are beyond their mental control. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation, the symptom of an allergy which differentiates these people, which sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, been permanently eradicated, gotten rid of. So there's no way that, and it's still true now, there's no way that medical science knows to get rid of that craving. Once you've got it, you've got it. And he says the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence, abstaining from the substance that creates the craving. Now, this paragraph is a very important paragraph in the history of Overeaters Anonymous. For 2 years, from 1960 to 1962, this program did not have an idea of sobriety. There were diets that were floating around, and people would work the 12 steps, but they were diets. And most of the people were following a program that was similar, actually, to the weight loss program that I used to follow, which gave you a lot of free foods. You ate all the time, but you would eat a lot of foods that didn't have any calories in between your meals. Your meals would have sort of weighed and measured foods, but you would eat celery and carrots and hot air popcorn, and you'd chew gum and you'd drink diet drinks, and you'd do whatever you can to keep your mouth busy. And one day, about 2 years into the creation of this program, Roseanne, the co-founder of OA, went to an open AA meeting where they read this particular paragraph that ends with, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And she suddenly had a brainstorm. She said, this is what we're missing in this program. We do not have a notion of sobriety. The alcoholic knows, you go into Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't drink. You go to Gamblers Anonymous, you don't gamble. You go to Cocaine Anonymous, you don't take cocaine. You go to Narcotics Anonymous, you don't use. Well, what is it that we don't do in OA? Said, we don't have that notion. This is what we have, the word abstinence. We abstain from compulsive eating. And she wrote a letter to the few OA groups that exist at that time. And I've seen that letter. It's actually, I think, in the book that she wrote called Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. Maybe not. I've seen it anyway. And she says something like, this is what we've been missing. We have to abstain from compulsive eating. And that means that between meals, we can't eat. We have to eat three meals a day, nothing in between, a day at a time. We cannot eat between meals, because if we eat between meals, we're overeating. Even if we're not eating foods that have calorie content, we're still eating. So I love that. I'm so pleased to know that I mean, for me, the word abstinence, although I disagreed with what it meant for 6 or 7 years, was the thing that kept me in OA, because I knew that in OA, somehow, if I worked the program, I would find a way to abstain. And I finally did it after I finally accepted the notion that there is something wrong with my body. Now, this is a disability. In the same way that someone who has who gets an anaphylactic shock from shrimp or peanuts has a disability. It's something that goes on in the body. People who have lost a leg have a disability, or they're challenged, whatever the word you want to use. They are people who do not have, whose bodies are different from, you want to say, normal people or other people. My disability is that when I start eating certain things, I get the phenomenon of craving. And when I get a phenomenon of craving, it overpowers my mind, and I can't stop. And I know that to be true. It accords with all my experience. My goose story, the fact that I ate in the midst of this guy vomiting, the fact that I continued to have my hand come to my mouth and bring me food while my mind was saying I gotta stop, the fact that I couldn't stop, this is a disability. It's no longer my fault. My only responsibility is to acknowledge it. I wear glasses. I don't throw my glasses away and pretend I don't have glasses. I don't need glasses. I need glasses to see. And I don't cry by the fact I need glasses. I just accept this disability. And when I go out driving, I recognize that I better have my glasses on, or else I'll drive dangerously and I'll put myself and other people in danger. My real problem, as it turns out, is that in OA, for a compulsive eater, my problem before this program, before I worked the 12 steps, was that my mind couldn't accept the fact that I have a disability and kept trying to persuade itself, you don't have this, you can have this stuff. But we'll get to that. Let's go back to the notion of what we abstain from. How do you decide what to abstain from? How do you develop a plan of eating that's right for you? The first thing is that it has to be right for you, and not that it's right for me. Don't accept my suggestions for myself as being the right suggestions for you. Don't accept anyone's suggestions as being the right suggestions for you. Someone may say to you, this works, this is your problem. How the hell do they know? What works for you is something you have to work out for yourself. That's essential. But it's also essential for you to be absolutely honest with yourself. And that is sometimes very tough. If you say, I can't stand the thought of not ever eating this, so I won't put this on my list of things to abstain from, it better be on your list of things to abstain from, because the chances are it's something you should be abstaining from. I'll tell you what I did, and then I'll tell you how I sponsor people. I'll tell you the experience of other people I know. I started off when I really, really, really read the big book, and I finally said, okay, I'd better accept this notion of the allergy. I made a list of my binge foods. I made a list of the foods that I knew I ate uncontrollably. And it wasn't a very, it was a long list, but it wasn't, I mean, it was a pretty obvious list. For me, most desserts were like that, but the biggest desserts I had were shortbread, ice cream, and cheesecake. Those were things I would eat until they were finished. I don't know how many of you here have done this, but when we used to have bricks of ice cream, I would eat the other end of the brick so no one would notice that I'd eaten the ice cream. I don't know what happened when they pushed the way through, but I would try and pretend somehow that I hadn't eaten. I've eaten a gallon of ice cream. I've had a tub of ice cream, and I've just eaten it. I said, I'll just have one more, and it just keeps coming. I've eaten ice cream that's gone bad in the freezer. I've scraped away the frost, you know, and it actually tastes pretty good. It's even more concentrated. It may taste stale, but somehow it's more concentrated. Cheesecake, I had taste. It had to be a certain kind of cheesecake, but that kind of cheesecake, amazing. Shortbread, my wife's family comes from Thunder Bay. She was born in Thunder Bay, and she would go visiting there and come home with 3 boxes of shortbread, one made by a first cousin and 2 made by aunts. And each of them thought that she made the best shortbread. I mean, they all had their different philosophy. One, you mix it, and then they use a fork to make it. It was square, it was round, it was baked for 10 minutes, it was baked for 11 minutes. You put holes in it, you didn't put holes in it. I mean, it's, you know, used all butter, sometimes used butter and something else, whatever it was. Well, my wife kind of liked shortbread, so she'd have one or two pieces, you know. But I did the taste testing. I had to know who made the best shortbread. Of course, by the time I finished the third, I couldn't remember the first. So I had to go back to the first. And I would finish those boxes within weeks, within a week. So shortbread was a problem. I also, goose skin was obviously a problem. And for me, animal fats were generally a tremendous problem. I mean, I loved the juicy steaks, the steaks with a lot of fat on them. I loved fried chicken skin, things of that sort. Those are things I loved. Not everyone loved them. I loved French fries. I loved potato chips. And I joke, but it's true, I used to have popcorn on my butter, not butter on my popcorn, because I love butter. So I started off by listing my binge foods and realizing I had to give those up. I had to abstain from those. They created cravings in me. And I also looked at to see whether there were ingredients that were common to all of them. And there is only one ingredient that's common to all of those, and that's fat. And I realized high fat content, generally speaking, is one of my big problems. And I think it's a problem of a lot of people, but not of everyone. And so I had specific foods, I also had general foods. I had to avoid high fat content. And so I developed a way of measuring the amount of fat in something. I didn't weigh and measure my ingredients, but I would only eat something if it were low fat. That meant I had to abstain from cheese, generally speaking. Although I could use cheese as a flavoring, like a Parmesan cheese as a flavoring, I could not eat cheese as a main ingredient because the cheese as a main ingredient was just too fat. I couldn't drink whole milk. I wouldn't even drink 2% milk. The only time I'd have 2% milk is if that was the only thing available, if I had a cappuccino, at a coffee shop. But I would not have it in a latte because lattes have much more milk in them. I wouldn't have 2% latte. I would only have a skim milk latte, because that's just too much fat for me. Occasionally I've had 1% milk, but I really have avoided that. Because it's just, there's something about butter fat that really gets to me. I don't have sour cream other than non-fat, things of that sort. I avoid nuts. I will not, for my protein, have nuts. Because nuts, for me, have too much fat and I end up eating too much of them. Now, nuts are very, very healthy, and they have good fat in them and all that. But for me, at this time, as I examine my own plan of eating, I cannot eat high fat content of any kind. Okay? I did that for about 6 months. And I worked the steps within those 6 months, actually probably more within 3 months. And I abstained from the ingredients and the binge foods that I had identified, which is all desserts. Plus, I would cut the fat off all my meats. There were no visible fats left in my meat. All the skin would be taken off. I wouldn't have cheese, and things of that sort. I abstained, and after I worked step 9, the promise of this program came true, and I didn't want to eat those things. I could look at them and say, why would I want butter? Why would I want cheese? Why would I want this stuff? It makes me sick to think of eating this because to go back, I never want to go back to what I used to be like. But I hadn't lost much weight. And my friend and I, by this time we were sponsoring each other because we had both recovered. We had both reached step 9. We had both recovered, so we were able to carry the message to each other. My friend and I started to discuss this. We were talking about carrying the message. I'm saying, I'm ready now to carry the message of recovery through the big book, 12 Steps, to those who still suffer. Am I a very good message carrier if I haven't lost any weight? I've abstained, but something else is going on. Why have I not lost weight? And my friend suggested, he had lost a lot of weight, my friend suggested I start to look at my plan of eating again. Had I really abstained from everything that caused me cravings? So I began to look at what I was eating, and I realized my quantities were really high. I was eating healthy food, but I was eating too much of it, especially around supper time and sometimes for lunch. So I began to look at why I was doing this. Now, around this time, a couple of things happened. Those of you who are more religious might believe it wasn't a coincidence, but a couple of things happened at the same time. One is, I was at my dentist. Early in the morning, he used to see me at 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning. And he was working in my mouth, and he said, "You haven't had breakfast yet." I said, "Yeah, I have," you know, because he was working in my mouth, but he understood me. I said, "Yes, I have." And he said, no, you haven't. I said, "No, I have. Why do you think I haven't?" He said, "Because you're salivating, and you only salivate when you're hungry." I thought, that was weird. Why am I salivating? I'm not hungry. I've eaten my breakfast. The other thing is I began to realize, what was he doing in my mouth? Well, he was giving me caps and crowns because I had worn away or broken all my teeth from eating bones, chewing on bones, chicken bones and steak bones and, you know, and stuff like that. I chewed all the time. And I began to realize that even though I was abstaining from, you know, high-fat stuff and eating only healthy foods, in between my meals, I was eating hot air popcorn, I was having celery and carrots and all the non-caloric foods that my old diet program had given me. My old weight loss program gave me the free foods, chewing gum, to keep my mouth busy. And then I read from the OA 12 and 12, pages 2 and 3. So I'm going to read you from that. Like compulsive overeaters, normal eaters will sometimes find pleasure and escape from life's problems in excess food. In other words, normal eaters will sometimes eat too much. Well, they do. My wife ate too much potato, you know. Too many toasted chicken salad sandwiches, too. Anyway, compulsive overeaters, however, often have an abnormal reaction when we overindulge. We can't quit. So you can see that they're talking about the phenomenon of craving, right? We compulsive eaters, overeaters crave. A normal eater gets full and loses interest in food. We compulsive overeaters crave more. Some of us even have a strange reaction to particular foods. While others can comfortably eat single portions of these foods, we feel compelled to eat another serving after we finish the first, and then another, and another. Not all compulsive overeaters can identify particular foods which give us this trouble, but many of us can. What all of us have in common is that our bodies and minds seem to send us signals about food which are quite different from those the normal eater receives. I mean, that's just right what the doctor is saying, right? We have found through much experience that no matter how long we abstain from eating compulsively, no matter how adept, how able we become at facing life's problems, we will always have these abnormal tendencies. This is the allergy of the body. Those of us who have returned to our former compulsive eating behaviors, even after years in recovery, have found it harder than ever to stop. Clearly, if we are to live free of the bondage of compulsive eating, we must abstain from all foods and eating behaviors which cause us problems. If we don't ever overeat, we won't trigger the reaction that makes us crave more. Eating behaviors. Somehow my mind put all this together, and I said to myself, my problem is that I may have abstained from the foods that cause me cravings, but I haven't identified the eating behaviors that have caused me cravings. And I began to say, well, what are the eating behaviors that have caused me cravings? Clearly, chewing all the time. Clearly, my mouth likes to be occupied. I'm one of those people who, if you have a little hole or a little broken off tooth, the tongue is going in there and moving around, and you know what I'm talking about? It's going in there. I love to chew. That's why I broke all my teeth, because I chewed on bones. I'm telling you, I would take a chicken home, one of those, you know, those baked chickens, roasted chickens that you get in the supermarket. I could eat the whole thing. This is before OA. I would throw away the skin and eat the whole thing after OA. But the bones would be gone. You would hardly see the bones. They'd be mashed up. All the marrow would from it would be gone. I'd be clean. A steak bone, T-bone, entirely clean. And I'd gnaw at it and get at it. So I realized one of my problems is I'm eating between meals, I'm keeping my mouth busy between meals, and what that means is when I finally get some calories into my mouth, at my healthy calories at my meal times, my mouth wants more. It wants to chew. And I realized I had to stop eating between meals. So I adopted that. I stopped eating between meals. I don't suck or chew anything between my meals. And then I thought to myself, there's one other thing, one other craving I have, which is pretty obvious, and that is I want to feel myself right up to the top of my neck, right up to my gorgle or my zatch or whatever it is, right? Just want to eat all the way. I want to be filled and packed. And yeah, I'm packed with healthy foods, but that's calories. You know, Roseanne, the co-founder of OA, talks about her Texas doctor. I can't do his accent, but he says something to her, "Honey, if you weigh too much for your body, you're taking in too many calories for your body." I mean, it's simple arithmetic. You know, forget about all these magic things. You take in more calories than your body needs, you're going to gain weight. You take in fewer calories than your body needs, you'll lose weight. Take in as many calories as your body needs, you stay the same. So I said, I have to find out a way to reduce the quantity so that I'm not filled up to the top. I have to resist that, because the need to be filled to the top means I eat too much. So I got a concept in my mind of eating up to my belly button. That made sense to me. Now, I gave this workshop a couple months ago somewhere else, and a nurse came up to me and says, you realize that your stomach is above your belly button, so how can you eat up to your belly button? I don't know the answer to that. All I know is when it gets up to my belly button, somehow I know I've had enough. Now, I have a friend who says, "Laurie, I don't know where my belly button is. I don't know how to do that." So he says, what I have to do is weigh and measure my food so I know I'm not eating anything more than my body needs. Seems to me quite reasonable. There must be a way. If quantity is an issue, you have to find a way to reduce the quantities. For me, quantity was an issue. I found a way to reduce it by getting rid of two eating behaviors. One is chewing all the time, because that just caused me the salivation and the need to chew more and eat more. And the other was eating all the way up to the top, filling myself, stuffing myself. Once I eliminated those two behaviors, I lost weight. Over the years, I've added foods to my list of things I abstain from. I discovered I would make myself hot air popcorn, or the equivalent of hot air popcorn, in a microwave, not in a hot air maker, without butter, and I'd have that as one of my carbohydrates at a supper time, for instance. But I found myself eating the whole bowl, and yeah, I didn't eat past my belly button, but I couldn't let any part of that popcorn go. And a friend of mine in the program that had been in the program for many years, had lost a lot of weight, kept it off, said, you know, whenever you get that attached to something, it's time to give it up. So I gave up popcorn. I haven't had popcorn for, I don't know, 10 years. I don't miss it. I make it for my wife because I make it better than she does, and she likes the way I make it. I don't miss it. Smells great, but I don't miss it. I discovered a rice cracker that had very few calories, and actually it was pretty nutritious, and didn't have sugar, but it had a wonderful taste to it. And I started eating it to the point that I would finish a box. Never go up to get past my belly button. It would be one of my meals. But I said to myself, I'm too attached to this stuff. So I stopped eating it. And other foods I've discovered over the years. I've also had to adapt. I have gone, as some of you know, on very strenuous one-week bicycle rides, in which I've gone, you know, 50 to 80 miles up and down hills in western North Dakota. Pretty strenuous stuff. I tried to eat three meals a day, nothing in between. I couldn't do it. I couldn't go up a hill at one point unless I ate something. I spoke to a friend of mine in the program, not in Winnipeg, but in the program, who is a triathlete. And I said, and she's you know, been in the program for a long time, kept her weight off. And I said, what do you do? She said, well, here's my advice. You undertake strenuous activity, you eat normally, and then you eat for that activity. You watch your food, but you have to eat more often. And so I did. And I went on a hiking holiday where I had a backpack and we were walking long distances, and I the only food I could bring with me were nuts and cheeses. I watched myself very, very carefully in those times, because that's where my protein came from. I watched very carefully to make sure I did not overeat, because I was very worried about the effect of it. I could handle it, but I don't handle it normally, and I don't do that normally, and I won't do that normally. Because I know that if I allowed myself to have cheese as a major protein, source of protein, me, I would start eating again. So I adapted. I have friends who normally eat at 9 o'clock. They invite us for supper and they end up eating at 9 o'clock. I discovered that if I don't eat my third meal, and I don't have something at 6 o'clock, I will overeat there at 9. Never past my belly button, although I admit my belly button moves up and down at times, but you know what I'm saying. I'm honest to myself in many ways. So I've had a meal at 5 o'clock just to make sure, you know, and then I eat less at 9 o'clock. So I work it out. So I adapt my plan of eating. But that's my plan of eating. I have friends who have I have things I abstain from. I have friends who say, that's much too hard for me. There are too many things for me to abstain from. I would rather have a list of things I can eat, not a list of things I can't eat. So they have a list of things that they can eat, and they only eat from that list. Of course, that eliminates all the foods they can't eat. So they have the same program, same kind of plan of eating, because any plan of eating means that you have to abstain from things that cause you cravings. So, okay, so we'll take a very, very brief break, and then I'll finish.